Thank you for tuning in. Stick around for a while. Listen, I'm really going to stir up the crazies third hour tonight. We're going to be talking about a subject that has kind of flown under the radar, at least in this country, and that is the beginnings of the third Palestinian Intifada that had its start last Sunday. We'll talk about that later. This hour is sponsored by Paula Piazza. Paula Piazza. That's a great name. Thanks, Paula. No message, just the sponsorship. The Senate today rejected a Republican attempt to speed up and expand offshore oil drilling permits and drilling in the face of $4 a gallon gasoline prices, which have nothing to do with oil. Anyway, a vote failed today, 57-42, on a Republican bid to speed up the process on drilling permits and force the Obama administration to conduct previously scheduled lease sales in the Gulf of Mexico and off Virginia's coast. Those sales, you remember, were suspended after the murder of the Gulf by British Petroleum. The vote comes just days after Obama directed his administration to ramp up U.S. oil production by extending existing leases in the Gulf and off Alaska's coast and holding more frequent leases in a federal petroleum reserve in Alaska. So his own party told him to sit down and shut up. So that's some good news. You know, it's just like a junkie, isn't it? I mean, it's just like a dope addict. It's like somebody who jams that needle in every chance they get, pumps in the heroin. And, you know, when they come out of their snooze, you say, look, you know, this is not good for you. You know, eventually you're going to kill yourself if you keep doing this. You got to stop, man. You got to stop. And the junkie says, yeah, I sure do. Excuse me now. I got to go score some more Mexican mud. And continues until eventually the junkie dies of an overdose or gangrene or blood poisoning. Eventually the junkie dies. And that's who we are. That's what we do with this dependence on a drug, oil, that is killing us all. Oh, well. We don't care. Bill Maher told Chris Matthews, Maher was on Matthews' program, and he said that the attention being paid to the Schwarzenegger case is overblown. He was on Hardball yesterday. Maher said that the revelation of the former governor's love child, quote, should not be a giant surprise, end quote. And Matthews, in his inimitable way, wondered if the scandal said anything about American politics. Jesus, God. No, Chris, it doesn't say anything about politics. It says an awful lot about men who can't keep their zippers zipped, but I don't think it says anything about politics. And Matthews asked Bill Maher, can't you compartmentalize? He noted that Schwarzenegger didn't do anything on public time. Well, okay. It's more about a form of rape, Chris, than it is about politics. It's more like forced sex or, oh, I don't know, Jesus, God. It's just, I don't know. Maher said, well, you can do that. You can compartmentalize, but not in America. You can do that in sophisticated countries. We are not one of those. We are a childish country. And if someone has their pee-pee in the news, it's going to be the top story. Right. You betcha. Oh, they also discussed Newt Gingrich, who started his campaign and immediately planted little sticks of dynamite around his campaign and blew it to hell. It's over. Newt Gingrich is dead meat. Of course, he's going to continue to play the game so he can impress his partner in adultery, who is now his wife, Kalista. And, you know, Newt is Newt. Newt sees himself as Julius Caesar or Richard Nixon or somebody. So even though his political campaign is absolutely dead, Newt is going nowhere. He's going to continue to make the rounds. Maher called him ugly inside and out. And Chris Matthews said Newt Gingrich looked like the devil. Oh, my. I thought I was the only one who made the infamous ad hominem attacks against people because of the way they looked. He looks like the devil? Well, Matthews is a Catholic, so he would know, wouldn't he? Yes, he would. Bill Maher noted that people often call Gingrich a professor, bursting with ideas. Well, he was over here at West Georgia College, not far from where our studio is. Maher said, but he's a professor of idiocy. He has never, ever been a brilliant man. Not only that, Bill, but he's never been a highly intelligent man. He knows how to put together sentences. He knows how to parse lengthy essays on historical economics or whatever the hell. I guess it was a professor of history. But he's you know, just a typical small-town college professor. No offense, if you're a small-town college professor, I'm sorry. Let me rephrase it. Newt is a typical small-town college professor as presented in literature. How's that? How's that for a qualifier? I'm thinking of perhaps Richard Burton's role in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? That kind of college professor. That's the way Newt was. And Newt's a bully, and he's a smart ass, but he's also dumb. He's just so stupid. Well, he is stupid. He's not ignorant, Kathy. He's stupid. There's a difference. Newt isn't ignorant. He has all kinds of facts crammed into his Cro-Magnon skull. Newt. The Defense Secretary Robert Gates is and Admiral Mike Mullen, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, they had a kind of a meeting today, and the two of them have ordered gossip and unauthorized leaks from U.S. officials, politicians, and retired military officers about the murder of Osama bin Laden to shut up. Gates and Mullen are both saying that continuing to talk about this is going to jeopardize the ability of special forces to carry out similar operations in the future. Oh, really? What? Who? Who's next? Sarkozy? Putin? Who's next? Chavez? Gates Robert Gates said, quote, too many people in too many places are talking too much about this operation, adding that the level of disclosures and blabbing violates an agreement reached in the White House Situation Room on May 8th to keep details of the raid private. Gates said, well, that lasted about 15 hours. I'll tell you what to do, Gates. Why don't you round up the people that are spilling the beans and revealing the secrets? Put them in a cell out there next to Bradley Manning. The Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mike Mullen, and Secretary of Defense Robert Gates are saying too many people are blabbing about the murder of Osama bin Laden. Mike Mullen said, quote, it's time to stop talking. In a directive to officials, politicians, and the retired military officers who get on these cable news programs and, tout their information. Mullen said, get off the net. God. Gates was at a meeting with hundreds of Marines at Camp Lejeune last week, and he acknowledged the concerns that the military-industrial establishment in this country, the national security state, the concerns that they have about future extrajudicial assassinations. You know, they're concerned about this. It's one thing to send in SEAL Team 6 and murder somebody. It's something else, again, to have people talk about it. You see, this is America. Our largest export is death. It is. It is. And all the, its various and sundry forms. Well, actually, two forms, cigarettes and military weaponry, some of which we use and some of which we sell to regimes from Israel to China that, China steals it. They go ahead then and commit death. But the death is one of our biggest exports, if not the biggest. So, you know, Gates has got his khakis in a wad here. You know, come on, boys, he said to the Marine Corps. At Camp Lejeune, he said the Defense Department had mounted, quote, a consistent and effective effort, end quote, to protect the identities of those who participated in the raid. You know, SEAL Team 6. Gates told the Marines, quote, we're very concerned about the security of our families, of your families and our troops, and also these elite units that are engaged in things like that. And he went on, and without getting into any details, I would tell you that when I met with the team last Thursday, they expressed a concern about that, and particularly with respect to their families. And so, I can't get into the details in this forum, but we are looking at what measures can be taken to pump up the security. Oh, come on. Come on, Robert. Are you serious? This was an historical event. The whole world took notice of this one. And you want people to be quiet who might have a little inside information? You're denying the psychology of blabbermouthism? Oh, man, I know what really happened. You know, I know who those guys were. You know, I have a cousin who works at the commissary whose best friend knows somebody whose uncle used to work with the father of one of those SEAL team members. I mean, come on. That's just human nature. That's just the way it goes. But Gates is getting his khakis, and Mullen is getting his dress blues, all in a wad about people talking. Well, Mr. Secretary, you know, Bradley Manning didn't really talk. What he did was provide information that was put up on a website, and you certainly have handled his case in a real straightforward manner. You snatched him and spent 8 months torturing him. Why don't you go after some of the people who are talking about your assassination team and do the same thing? White House National Security Advisor Tom Donilon initially disclosed sketchy details of the raid the day after it happened. But more information came from Capitol Hill staff, from members of Congress after members were briefed on the operation. And as retired SEALs and others began explaining tactical details, officials and politicians have discussed the stealth helicopter that the SEALs were forced to leave behind after it malfunctioned, and the use of stealth drones that watched the compound for weeks before the raid, blah, 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 blah. Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, said, quote, "We have gotten to a point where we are close to jeopardizing the precision capability that we have, and we can't afford to do that. This fight isn't over," end quote. The precision capability. I see. And so to the hundreds of Afghan men, women, and children who have been turned into chunks of bloody meat, your precision capability is meaningless, Admiral.
Mike Malloy.
Storing every little file. Make a promise and take a while. Hooked up to a set.
25 before the hour. Did you hear this one? From CNN. The Secret Service. Somebody working for the Secret Service today posted his or her personal dislike for Fox News in an official tweet. It was at the @Secret Service Twitter account. It read, "Had to monitor Fox for a story. Can't deal with the blathering." According to the Secret Service, the tweet was immediately removed and an internal follow-up is underway. Jesus, God. Here in the peanut capital of America, here in Georgia, an investigation by one of the local television stations found out that Delta Airlines gave some of Georgia's most powerful in-state political figures campaign contributions that, you know, people who fly like you do or I do would love to have. They're all Republicans. All the statewide office holders in this state are Republicans. And all the constitutional officers, I guess I should say, and the House and the Senate here is totally dominated, lopsided, amazingly so, with Republican swine. The TV station looked into whether Delta grossly undervalued the contributions. I'm sure most of you know who Clark Howard is. He's a syndicated consumer radio program. He's someone I used to work with here in Atlanta. He said that a platinum upgrade is worth between $10,000 and $15,000 a year, which is far more than Delta valued it. Delta said it was worth about $1,600. Woo! God, I'd like to have one. I could probably borrow $1,600 from someplace and get one of those upgrades. They're not worth $1,600. They're worth 10 times that. They're worth about $16,000 a year. Anyway, the lieutenant governor here, whose name is Casey Cagle, yep, that's his name, and five top Republican legislators were on the receiving end for either platinum or gold upgrades, plus one legislator who's no longer in office. And Clark Howard knows that these free medallion upgrades are a huge bonus for anyone who's had to put up with air travel, you know, the long lines, security checks, all this crap you have to go through now. But with a platinum frequent flyer status or gold frequent flyer status, you go through a special security line at the airport and many other airports around the country. Of course, it only counts here at Hartsfield-Jackson Airport, the busiest airport on earth. You also get automatic upgrades to first class for free seats, if free seats are available. You get huge bonus frequent flyer miles every time you fly, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, the investigative reporter found the names of the recipients on the State Ethics Commission's website, where contributors and political candidates have to disclose what they give and receive. And all the top political figures, did I mention this, enjoying these benefits from Delta are Republicans. One of these upgrades went to Representative Jay Roberts, who's the chairman of the Georgia House Transportation Committee, which oversees the airlines, especially Delta. Senator Ronnie Chance, chairman of the Economic Development Committee, that speaks for itself, and House Majority Leader Larry O'Neill. The House Speaker Pro Tem, Jan Jones, got a platinum update. Senate President Pro Tem, Tommy Williams. Former House Majority Leader, Jerry Keane. Delta sent the television station here a statement saying it supports elected leaders with campaign contributions. Well, if they're already elected, oh, never mind. But did not offer a detailed explanation of the way it valued the medallions that are worth around $15,000 a year. And Delta says, no, they're only worth $1,600. It's astonishing. So all of these elected officials, the big shots in the Republican House and Senate in the state of Georgia, including the lieutenant governor, I'm surprised this thuggish thief who is now the governor, what's his name? Deal? What's his first name? Huh? Nathan. I'm surprised he didn't get one. But this is violation of the law, which simply means that nothing will happen. These are Republicans. God damn it, these are Republicans. This is what Republicans do. They are cheesy, little, sneaky slime balls. I don't care if they're here or in Wisconsin or California. They're cowardly. They lie, cheat, steal. They're just, I don't know. Anytime, remember back in the day people talk about gaydar? Remember gaydar? Hey, I know he's gay. How do you know that? My gaydar is going up. I have something similar to that, only it's Republican-der. Republic-dar. I can't give it a name yet. But if I'm walking down a street or in a park or an amusement park or sitting down somewhere and somebody walks by, ding, 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 ding. It goes off. It goes off in my head. I can tell. There's something about Republicans. Maybe there's a smell that is, you know, not noticeably detectable with your nose. I don't know. It's awful. You want some more Republican? Let's leave the swamp that is the Georgia General Assembly. Eric Cantor. Eric Cantor. I mean, who does he remind you of from your high school class? Huh? You know, Eric Cantor, who is second in command in the House now, right? Who does he, you know he does. You know he reminds you of somebody from back in high school. Yeah, okay. Anyway, yesterday morning, House Majority Leader Eric Cantor visited the Chicago headquarters of the CME Group. They call themselves the world's largest owner and operator of private exchanges for derivatives products. In other words, the CME Group, well, it specializes in a number of markets, including trading futures contracts, for various blends of crude oil and food commodities. Huh? In other words, they are predators. The CME Group is a group of predators. They are one of the companies that are the reason people are paying $4 a gallon at the gas pump. They involve themselves in commodities futures. They bid them up. They get these big contracts. They trade them among the wealthy. The wealthy cash them in. Then somebody else trades them up. Other wealthy people, they trade, they cash them in, and it just, they just push the paper back and forth. Nothing is produced, nothing is drilled, nothing is built, nothing is manufactured, but they make millions, billions, and who pays for it? Yeah, that's right, you do, and me. Even you teabag dumbasses, you pay for this, but you don't care. You don't care, because the president was born in Kenya. Anyway, so Eric Cantor goes there and to CME Group headquarters in Chicago. He meets with the executives, and at one point he gave some remarks before the employees and other various commodity speculators. This is according to Think Progress. Cantor told the audience of speculators that his Republican caucus would, quote, do our part, end quote, to block the implementation of financial reforms passed last year as part of the sweeping Dodd-Frank law. He even called the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, those are the regulators that are supposed to be in charge of overseeing derivatives and energy speculation. He said, he called out that agency and promised to stop regulations from being posted online. What he said was, quote, and you've managed to be able to serve that function in the CME Group for so much of this country and the world, and you've also managed to position as a true world leader. We want that in every arena. We want to help you continue to lead for America. That means we got to do our part. When you see the implementation of Dodd-Frank coming at you like a barreling train, we want to help control that so we can get some sensible follow-up to that legislation, whether it's the EPA, the FDA, the FCC, the SEC, the CFTC, you name it, there is an acronym for a federal agency causing harm right now, and we're trying to pull that in. Causing harm. Harm to whom? Eric, you little twit bastard, you. Who are these agencies causing harm to? Any teabaggers out there? Do you people want to take a shot at answering a simple... Oh, never mind. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
high, monkey-free fun and frivolity with Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. This hour has been sponsored by Paula Piazza. Thank you, Paula. Paula Piazza. God, I love that name. Our first hour sponsor tonight. Our only sponsor tonight. No message, just the sponsorship. Thanks, Paula. So Eric Cantor, number two Republican in the House, tells the execs and some of the commodity speculators who work at the CME Group, the world's largest owner and operator of private exchanges for derivatives products. Yeah, they all get together in this little nest of thieves and manipulators, and the rest of the world pays. The rest of the world pays for what these thugs do. And they bid up the price of everything. And then you and I pay for it, whether it's food, energy products, real estate contracts, loans. It doesn't make any difference. This is how you make money in predatory capitalist America. You don't manufacture anything. As a matter of fact, you get all your manufacturing out of the country. Send it someplace where labor is cheaper and unions are against the law. See how that works? Very simple. And then after you have gutted the economy, then instead of making stuff, you start pushing paper around. Now, the average dolt out here, the Republicans who vote you into office, vote these capitalist pigs into office, and some Democrats, too, they don't play in this league. You know, they may own a few shares of Pepsi stock, and they think they're shareholders. Oh, my God, that is so 20th century. The real money is made out of nothing except future prices. And future prices, of course, affects everybody. Now, the ultra-wealthy, they don't give a goddamn. You know, milk's what? $7 a gallon? Oh, pfft, so what? I mean, when you're making $1 billion a year or $100 million or $50 million, you think $7 a gallon milk is going to bother you? Jesus Christ, if it bothers you, just go buy a dairy farm in Vermont or something and, you know, hire some illegals to run it. Very simple. Jesus Christ, that is easy stuff, man. But Eric Cantor has said to these people, an attempt by the U.S. Congress, two members, Christopher Dodd and Barney Frank, to rein you predatory, blood-sucking sons of bitches in, to set up some regulations that should have been there to begin with and were there one time. Don't worry, boys. I'm Eric Cantor. I will make sure, as will my buddies in the Republican Party, that this never flies. So keep gouging and screwing and doing whatever you want to do. Oh, and don't forget to contribute to my campaign, because eventually I'm going to slide the shiv between the fourth and fifth ribs of my good friend, John Boehner, and he's going to collapse. We'll set him up. One of these nights, all of a sudden, word will come out that he has been discovered in a Washington, D.C. hotel with a case of Merlot and a hooker. And that'll be the end of him. That's why I'm here. I am Eric Cantor. The dweeb of all dweebs. I know back in high school everybody hated my ass, but I'm... Oops. Don't do that with your throat. But I'm all of a sudden very powerful. And I will make sure to you commodity speculators, you finest examples of predatory, vicious, devouring capitalism, you IMFers, take that any way you want to, you World Bank supporters, I will protect you. I am Eric Cantor. Thank you for putting me in office. Anything! Now, while Eric is spouting off like this, of course, the hedge fund managers and the speculators and the derivatives freaks and, you know, they're all sitting back there going, Jesus Christ, who is this guy? Oh, he's Boehner's butt boy. I see. So he thinks he's got the power over us? He's doing us a favor? Well, let him think that. That's how we play the game. How much does this jackass make? 100 and what a year? You are kidding me. Jesus Christ, I spent that much on a week's vacation with my kids last month. Oh, well, let him continue to blow hard, and we'll just continue to, you know, keep him in office. I remember a guy like him in high school. We used to pants him. Yeah, usually between third and fourth period. We'd catch him in the hall and pull his drawers down. Oh, it was great fun. He used to squeal and scream. Yeah, I remember Eric Cantor. Eric went on, "We want to help you continue to lead for America. That means we got to do our part. When you see the implementation of Dodd-Frank coming at you like a barreling train." Oh, I already said that? Okay, we want to help control that so we can get some sensible follow-up. It's very troubling, but we've got similar instances in much of a lot of other arenas. It's not just financial services where federal bureaucracy has run amok. Don't worry, boys. I and my Republican friends, we're going to make sure that Dodd-Frank goes the same way as Glass-Steagall. Don't worry. Don't worry. The good times are going to continue. Good times for you guys. Just know that I'm there with you. And don't forget to support me when I finally do slide the thin, sharp knife between Boner's fifth and sixth ribs. Or is that fourth and fifth? We'll be back. The Malloy program. Regarding that directive by Mike Mullen, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mike Mullen, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Robert Gates, Secretary of Defense. Don in Redwood City, California writes in, "Mike, not sure if many remember this, but Melvin Laird issued a similar directive during the Vietnam War, prohibiting service members from making comments regarding the war to the press. The directive was short-lived when someone pointed out that the directive was a violation of the Hatch Act." Don in Redwood City, California, one of the people that went on that progressive cruise with us. Melvin Laird, oh my God, you remember him? I'd almost forgotten him. There's so many scum suckers in the Nixon administration, some of whom wound up in the Bush joke. Okay, I think it's time for our almost nightly report from Prairie 2. Jesus God, this guy writes a lot. All right. Let's see if he used spell check this time before he sent it to me. The subject line is only a crime if done by a criminal. Or she was looking for it. Ooh, okay. Everybody knows Ben Stein, crotchety old lawyer and sometimes actor that comes out on a regular basis to lecture the peasants on how good they have it and remind them that this is only because of the genius and hard work of the rich among us. He pretends to know a lot about economics and business, but really he just pushes the talking points that come down from the think tanks funded by the Koch brothers. Stein came to prominence in Republican circles as a speechwriter for Nixon and Ford. He has always maintained that Nixon was driven from office, or that Nixon being driven from office was a disaster, and that the so-called evidence from Deep Throat was simply made up by Woodward and Bernstein. He has maintained this stance even after a senior FBI official was identified as the source. Remember that guy? When was that? A couple years ago? Remember that guy? Ben knows what his job is, and he has sprung into action to defend the alleged rapist Dominique Strauss-Kahn, describing his treatment, the alleged perps treatment, as shameful. How dare they put him in a common jail? Stein is careful to point out that he has never met the man. This didn't stop him from writing an 8-point defense of him, based largely on the fact that DSK comes from a class of people that should be treated better. Stein also points out that the alleged victim of the rape is a maid. And while most hotel maids that Ben has known have been fine, hardworking people, some have been, quote, complete lunatics, end quote, who stole from Ben on many occasions. The other 7 points are equally filled with absurd arguments that revolve around proving, quote, quote, that the rich guy is innocent. But let's look at just one point. Point number two. This is what Ben Stein wrote. In life, events tend to follow patterns. People who commit crimes tend to be criminals. For example, can anyone tell me any economists who have been convicted of violent sex crimes? Jesus. Can anyone tell me of any heads of nonprofit international economic entities who have never been charged and convicted of violent sex crimes? Is it likely that just by chance this hotel maid found the only one in this category? Maybe Mr. Strauss-Kahn is guilty, but if so, he is one of a kind, and criminals are not usually one of a kind, end quote. Holy oncoming rapture. I've never heard an argument like that. Wow. All right, back to Prairie 2. Stein asserts, as a logical premise, that no other economist has ever been convicted of violent sex crime, so it couldn't have happened this time because it has never happened before. The fact is that violent sex crimes committed by strangers are relatively rare, and international economists with this kind of power are a very small number. This one event will doubtless spike the percentage of indicted economists to a high multiple compared to the general population. Where Stein says, quote, is it likely that just by chance this hotel maid found the only one in this category, end quote? Well, I don't think she was looking for a rapist, but was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. But is Stein just stupid? Or is it the old Nixon speechwriter? Is the old Nixon speechwriter using a statement to, you know, telegraph an idea? She was looking for it. Events tend to follow patterns, he writes. People who commit crimes tend to be criminals, he writes. She does this all the time. This is, of course, the modus operandi of the people in Stein's business. Create the illusion that the rich sociopaths can do no wrong, and the poor are just opportunists always out to take advantage. After all, the rich were chosen by God to rule over us, so by definition, it can't be a crime. Nothing Ben Stein's masters do to the rest of us are crimes, and don't you forget it. PrairieNumeral2.com. If you go to his website, he has posted the URL for the original article by Stein, and you can look at all 7 points. Man, I've never heard that argument before. Events tend to follow patterns, blah, 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 blah. So since economists are not generally charged with the sex crime, how could this guy be guilty? Well, that's true. And governors don't tend to have a child with someone who is not his wife, so how could Schwarzenegger be guilty? Ben Stein is a half-witted moron. Jesus Christ, he's just an absolute moron. I don't like him. I don't like to look at him or listen to him. I'd almost rather look at and listen to Eric Cantor. A lot is made about the attack on unions. And we mentioned the other night in Connecticut, the governor there, Dan Malloy, got an agreement that included $1.6 billion in cuts of various kinds from state workers. And the contract has not been ratified yet, but Malloy referred to the agreement as, quote, historic because of the way we achieved it. We respected the collective bargaining process, and we respected each other. He's talking about the union heads, negotiating in good faith without fireworks and without anger, end quote. Well, when I, reported on that to you last week, at the time, I thought to myself, yeah, well, okay, that makes sense, because the union's got a guarantee that there would be no layoffs or whatever for, 4 years? And just skimming over the article, I thought, well, this makes sense. It sure as hell beats what went down in Wisconsin by the governor there. What was his name? Who's the guy in Wisconsin? Walker? And it sure as hell beats what happened in Michigan and Ohio. But I got something here that was on Truth Out. And it talks about the real serious hidden attack on unions and where it's coming from. You might find this interesting. Stick around. Bigger threat to the unions right now, Republicans or Democrats? Seamus Cook, writing at Truth Out, says it's Democrats. He says the cover-up of the Democrats' national anti-union agenda is possible because if it were revealed, it would cause enormous disturbances for the Democratic Party, some labor leaders, liberal organizations, and consequently the larger political system. You know, your humble and obedient servant here has been talking about this now for a couple of years, about the utter uselessness of the Democratic Party. And I know that's hard to take for lifelong Democrat, so it was hard for me to take. I spent the better part of 40 years trying to see the Democrats were elected, all the way down to city council members here in Atlanta, up to, of course, like you, the President of the United States. And after having been lied to, conned, and betrayed so many times by this Democratic Party, you know, I made it very clear that I'm not a Democrat. I'm truly an independent. Now, that doesn't mean I'd never vote for somebody who has a D after their name. Sure, I would. But I will never contribute to Democratic Party fundraising events or anything of the sort when they're just general like that. If a candidate who has a D behind his or her name approaches me for a contribution or airtime, and I take a look at what that candidate is about, sure, I'll consider that and have done that. So a lot of people write me emails and say, well, you know, you say you're not a Democrat, but you sponsor or you have Democratic candidates on. You're missing, I think, what my point is, and I think I've just made it clear once again. But the Democratic Party, especially during the Clinton years, under the Democratic Leadership Conference, utterly and absolutely declared itself, and so has Barack Obama, on the side of corporate America. There is no qualification there, okay? Barack Obama has a certain mindset about who he wants to hang out with, and I'll guarantee you it's not people walking a picket line trying to make sure that they that their pension isn't stolen from them or that they don't get laid off and outsourced and their jobs sent to China. Obama would rather walk with the people from Goldman Sachs, obviously, look at his cabinet, or General Electric, or Chase, or, you know, Barack Obama is the perfect capitalist, the perfect operative, I should say, for the capitalists, because he gives a certain impression that is hard not to notice. He's young, he's articulate, he can sway an audience. He's a good speaker. And the fact that he is of mixed race gives the impression to most racists in this country, and I would include in that group millions of liberals, that because he has dark skin, he must be a liberal. That is a form of racism that is pungent, if you know what I mean. So, the Obama administration, top to bottom, with one or two noticeable exceptions, and they won't be around too much longer, is antithetical to and totally against organized labor, organized anything. Barack Obama is the type. Who's talking about this right now? Cornel West? I know there's been a dust-up. I haven't read West's comments about Obama, but I understand that they border on Democratic Party heresy. But usually when something borders on Democratic Party heresy, it's usually the truth. There are a lot of liberals or Democrats, they describe themselves that in media, especially television, who are punks. They're just absolute overweight punks. They don't. They're not about liberalism or progressivism at all. They're about kissing the ass of the Democratic Party leadership in this country, and the Democratic Party leadership is collectively kissing the ass of capitalist America. That's just the way it is. In the meantime, the Republicans are trying to destroy everything. The Democrats don't want to destroy everything. They just want to be on the winning team, and if that means ass kissing, then they'll do it. You know what I'm talking about. Here's a short list of states with Democratic governors where labor unions are undergoing severe attacks. You ready? Massachusetts, that's our friend Malloy. Connecticut, Oregon, California, New York, Illinois, Washington, Hawaii, Minnesota, Maryland, and New Hampshire. And other states with Democratic governors, you didn't think there were that many Democratic governors left, did you? Other states with Democratic governors are attacking unions to a lesser degree. But more on this when we come back. And, you know, the Republican Party is disintegrating and breaking into a million pieces like shattered glass. But the Democratic Party is also has turned out to be an absolute farce.
is a good word. It's more Mike Malloy.
Before the hour, you are listening to the Malloy program. The governors of all those states, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Oregon, California, New York, Illinois, Washington, Hawaii, Minnesota, Maryland, and New Hampshire, they're all Democrats. And the Democrats in those states have sought to distance themselves from the Republican governors of Wisconsin and Ohio, who have specifically attacked the collective bargaining rights of unions. And as Seamus Cook, writing at Truthout, points out, the Democrats in the states I just mentioned all hide their anti-union attacks behind, quote, a deep respect for collateral bargaining, end quote, a position that's not dissimilar to that of a thief who will steal your car, but out of respect will not target your deceased grandmother's diamond earrings. For example, this is what we talked about the other night. The anti-union Democratic governor of Connecticut thinks he has gotten a $1.6 billion cut from state workers. The contract has not been ratified yet. But remember, the governor, who he and I share the same last name, Malloy, referred to the agreement as, quote, historic because of the way we achieved it. We respected the collective bargaining process, and we respect each other, negotiating in good faith without fireworks and without anger, end quote. I don't quite get this, because the only purpose for collective bargaining rights is to set wage levels and benefit levels, whether those benefits are retirement agreements, health care agreements, vacation agreements. That's what collective bargaining is all about. How do you respect collective bargaining process when the function of the collective bargaining process was just destroyed? So it's not just teabag halfwits who use Orwell's newspeak. It's also Democratic governors. Washington State's anti-union Democratic governor uses similar language. This is what how it was put by the governor in Washington. They, the labor unions, contributed to fixing the state budget deficit with a salary cut. They contributed by paying more in health care. They've stepped up and said, we want to be a part of the solution. And I did it by going to the table, respecting their collective bargaining rights, and we got the job done, end quote. Oregon's anti-union Democratic governor is demanding a 20 to 25% pay cut for state workers. He went on, but, the governor said, those concessions will be made across a bargaining table through our collective bargaining process and with mutual respect, end quote. Now, as Cook points out, Seamus Cook points out, normally this garbage wouldn't fool a fourth grader, but some labor leaders are playing dumb in the hopes that the current attacks will not ruin the longstanding friendship, let's call it, between unions and Democrats. Now, one would hope that that kind of hope is founded on an illusion, because workers are not so blind as to overlook the fact that the governors they campaigned for are now launching an unprecedented attack on their wages and their benefits. What do you call that? Do you call that betrayal? What do you call that? Seamus Cook goes on, but by minimizing the Democrats' role in targeting unions, some labor leaders are disarming the labor movement. By minimizing the Democrats' role in targeting unions, some leaders are disarming the labor movement. This is what Ron Gettelfinger did with the United Auto Workers before he took his retirement. Ron Gettelfinger single-handedly almost destroyed, and in fact did destroy, the United Auto Workers. But I digress. On the one hand, leaders of both the AFL-CIO and Change to Win, to labor organizations, umbrella organizations, have clearly named the stakes following the events of in Wisconsin. Quote, labor is in the fight of its life, end quote. That's one of their more accurate observations, as well as, quote, the corporations are out to bust unions, end quote. On the other hand, both of these union federations, AFL-CIO and Change to Win, have also made excuses for the anti-union Democratic Party, enabling labor to be vulnerable on its left flank to the anti-union attack. Sometimes, you know, you have to be careful what's the saying? Hold your friends close. Hold your enemies closer. Seamus Cook goes on, the fight against massive cuts in wages and benefits cannot be separated from the attack on collective bargaining. They are two sides of the same coin. Workers only care about collective bargaining, as I just mentioned, because it enables them to improve their wages and benefits. A union that agrees to massive cuts in wages will not remain a union for long, i.e. the UAW, since workers will not want to pay dues to an organization that cannot protect them. Concessionary bargaining, you know, where the workers have to give up stuff, destroys the power of a union in the same way that cancer destroys the body. Fighting against concessionary bargaining is the essence of the fight. This is a real lesson of what happened to workers in Wisconsin. Workers want to fight back against a nationwide attack against their livelihoods, whether it is against wages and benefits or against collective bargaining. The AFL-CIO and the Change to Win organizations realize this to a certain degree. They're separately creating campaigns to deal with the attack, with the Service Employees International Union jumping out in front with its fight for a fair economy. But these union campaigns are doomed to fail if the energy they generate is funneled into the 2012 campaign of Barack Obama. My, my. Seamus Cook goes on. The attack workers are facing is colossal. Any successful union campaign will require massive resources and energy. If workers are told to halt their campaigns, to door knock and make phone calls for Obama, the campaigns will lose all legitimacy, since Obama has established himself as, ding, 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 a friend of Wall Street, and thus no friend to workers. Voting for Democrats has a demoralizing effect on workers when the inevitable betrayal happens, and demoralized union workers will not fight as effectively for their own pro-union campaigns. Shocking? NESPA? Seamus goes on, if a union campaign is to be successful, workers must be energized around it. SEIU's campaign focuses largely on making more connections with other labor and community groups, which is very positive. However, without waging an energetic battle to prevent state workers from making these concessions, the campaign by SEIU will fail. Essential lesson, workers who make massive concessions will be demoralized and not take the union campaign seriously. The fight to defend state workers has the potential, as Wisconsin proved, to unleash tremendous fighting energy among workers while also uniting those in the broader community who are eager for working people to fight back. But if labor unions continue down the current path of making huge concessions in wages and benefits while they excuse the Democrats for attacking them, the movement will wither and die. Seamus Cook says more at truthout.org, but that's the essential part of what he said. We have been talking on this program, like I mentioned, for a couple of years now about how the Democratic Party is truly the worst enemy of organized labor. And the reason is they are cloaked in the lie that they are working for the interests of organized labor. The Republicans, there's no question. You know, when you see your enemy and you can get him in your, oh, what did all those Republican teabag candidates say? In your crosshairs, it's much easier to understand who your real enemy is. This is one of the big arguments black civil rights workers and leaders and organizers had about the difference between the South and the North. In the South, they knew who their enemies were because their enemies made no bones about it. White rednecks in the South, easy to identify. White rednecks in the North, not so easy. Not so easy at all. That's why, you know, the most segregated city in America is, don't you? We used to live there. Chicago. We'll be right back.
Fun and frivolity with Mike Malloy.
I need this hopeless feeling, like I need a hole in my head. Give up my whole day's wages to get this hole in the wall. I call a holster that is empty, just a gun to the head.
10 before the hour. Coming up next hour, this should be interesting. There were two articles written over the weekend. Well, not really over the weekend, but regarding events over the weekend. One, front page New York Times on Monday. Israeli troops fire as marchers breach borders. That was in the Times. It was written by Ethan Bronner. And published, at least where I got it from, the Asia Times, by Pepe Escobar, Arab Revolution Knocking on Israel's Door. And both of the articles cover the same event. And it's very interesting. One of them, Ethan Bronner, obviously, is more of a, well, I shouldn't say obviously, you may not know who he is, but he is, you know, he's a journalist. In pretty much the standard definition of a journalist, he doesn't write nuanced reporting. His reporting may be a bit slanted, but you have to have your own particular agenda, I think, in order to find the slant, if you understand what I mean. Whereas Pepe Escobar, on the other hand, writes about the events of last weekend in the occupied territories, and Syria, and Lebanon, and Egypt, from more of a, if not subjective point of view, more of a storyteller's point of view, with a particular political agenda. So, being willing to take on the Israel lobby in this country the way that I am, and by Israel lobby, you know, I'm referring to AIPAC and the Zionists. I am not referring to people who believe in a two-state solution. The Israeli peace groups who believe that the Palestinians have been forced into an apartheid state over the past half century. American Jews and Jews around the world who see what the government of Bibi Netanyahu and his predecessors have done to the human dignity of Palestinians. Those are not the people who write me scathing, nasty, hateful letters and accuse me of being the type who would have been a guard at Auschwitz or Dachau or some other Nazi death camp. So for you people who have that knee-jerk reaction anytime somebody mentions the, here comes a cliche, the plight of the Palestinians, I look forward to your emails. I keep all of them. Eventually, there'll be a chapter in a book at some point. So let them roll. But the issue in the Middle East, so-called, you know what I'm talking about, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, that has been a cancer since 1948. And the reason it happened last weekend, because it was May 14th, 1948, that Israel declared, or the UN declared, or somebody declared, the establishment of its state. And the subsequent ethnic cleansing of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who were shoved or fled from their own land has been a cancer that just continues. It continues without let up. And the consequences of that conflict are seen in so many of the conflicts that are going on right now. The revolutions that are occurring in Arab states, the attack on this country, at least the official story for the attack on this country, the inability of U.S. foreign policy to, under Democratic or Republican president, to make a stand for dignity, truth, honesty, the refusal of America, the United States, I should say, the refusal of the United States in UN resolution after UN resolution to insist that its client, Israel, follow international law. The Israelis have broken or refused to acquiesce to how many UN resolutions? Now, nobody has to follow UN resolution. I mean, that's hog's not. It's just pro forma. But certain countries that do not follow UN resolutions are immediately economically sanctioned and walled off from the international community. That doesn't happen with Israel. Now, one can be in favor of a state of Israel living, how did George Bush put it, side by side in peace and harmony with the, a Palestinian state. One can be in favor of that, or at least indicate that he or she is in favor of that, and yet work against the accomplishment of a two-state solution. And I think this is what AIPAC and various Jewish lobbies in this country have done historically for the past half century, and will continue to do it until finally. And this is, I think, what Ethan Bronner and Pepe Escobar were writing about in the past few days, the inevitable Intifada III, if you want to call it that, that is approaching. It's coming. The Palestinians are no less inclined to rebel for their freedom than the Egyptians, the Syrians, or the Yemenis, the people in any of these countries where human dignity has been taken from them in so many instances by Arab leaders or Arabic-speaking leaders. Well, the Palestinians don't have that issue. They have the issue of having their dignity smashed by the leaders of the State of Israel. And the confrontation, the explosion, is surely coming. And I think both Ethan Bronner and Pepe Escobar try to make that point. We'll be back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. is 7 past the hour. Hour 3 of the Molloy program. If you subscribe to New York Times, you may have been kind of taken by the front page photo and article above the fold a couple of days ago on Monday. There is a full-color picture of people scrambling over a fence at the Israeli-Syrian border. You can see, well, let me see here. According to the photo, there must be 30, 40, 50 people in this photo trying to climb over two fences. There's a no-man's land strip at the Israel-Syrian border. And you can see the Palestinian flags as these people scramble to get over the fences. Israeli troops fired on the crowd, killing 4. That was not the only death on Sunday. And so I read the article in the front page of New York Times by Ethan Bronner. And under the headline, Israeli troops fire as marchers breach borders. Then the subhead, uprisings branch out. And then the subhead, Palestinians take their lead from protests sweeping the region. So I read the article by Ethan Bronner for the Times. And in reading the article, realized, you know, that Ethan Bronner did a good job of presenting the facts as to what's occurring with the Palestinians. It's a very volatile situation. It is the next flashpoint in the Middle East. Look for a third intifada to begin, a third uprising of the Palestinian people after living in refugee camps for the past, well, more than half a century, in 2 or 3 or 4 different countries. The time is fast approaching when the Palestinians are going to reach that tipping point, and there is going to be enormous violence in the Middle East. In my opinion, having been paying attention to this, as I have since the first intifada, modern intifada, in the 80s, the violence this time is going to make the Arab uprisings in these various countries in North Africa and the Middle East seem like mere rehearsals. There is a clash coming, I'm afraid, that is going to be very, very, very violent and very, very bloody. And the reasons for it, of course, are I think most people who follow or who have been following, not for the past half century, but who have been following the events in the Middle East, understand that the potential for violence is has always been there and has been exacerbated by Israeli policies and UN or inaction on UN resolutions that have attempted over the decades to find some sort of justice for the Palestinian people. Let me state clearly that I expect the barrage avalanche of "you hate Jews" emails to come in. Go ahead. It doesn't mean squat to me. I in fact don't. I've said this so many times. I don't look at groups. I really don't. I try to look at individuals. But the injustices perpetrated against the Palestinian people at some point have got to be acknowledged by more than just Israeli peace activists and the Palestinians themselves and people around the globe who see what has been happening and the violence perpetrated against people whose only misfortune was to have been born and lived in villages and towns on a strip of land that Other people came and said, no, this is ours. They're given to us by God. Get your asses out of here, or we'll kill you. Get out. So I do believe in the establishment and maintenance of two states on that little strip of land. A Jewish state on the one hand, and an Arab-Palestinian state on the other. I don't know how politicians on either side of that issue feel about it any longer, whether or not there is any kind of mental drift toward establishing a two-state solution to this horror. But just from my perspective, a two-state solution seems to be a solution. My feeling is that demographically, it probably won't happen. I say demographically because people of Arab heritage or descent or culture, whatever you want to call it, even inside the borders of the state of Israel are starting to outnumber the Israeli Jews. And demography is destiny in so many instances in so many countries. It just is. You wind up, if the rights of people who live in these countries or these areas are not recognized, you wind up with South African-style apartheid, which Israel is very close to right now anyway. But when you have a white minority, as existed in South Africa for a very, very long time, a white minority that controls absolutely a black majority. You know the history of apartheid in South Africa, I assume, and the destruction and horror and that produced. That is the direction, of course, that Israel and the Palestinians are drifting toward. But digressing here, wandering all over the place, I had two choices to share with you. Israeli troops fire as marchers breach borders by Ethan Bronner in the New York Times. On the same day, in the Asia Times, an article by Pepe Escobar, whose name you may or may not know. He is a progressive or leftist or liberal or populist or whatever you want to call him, writer. He's also an author. He has a number of books out, most notably the book Globalism, How the Globalized World is Dissolving into Liquid War. That came out a couple of years ago. He has another book out, Red Zone Blues, A Snapshot of Baghdad During the Surge. And then a new book just out is Obama Does Globalization. All of these are published, I believe, by Nimble Books. Pepe Escobar had an article describing pretty much the same events as described in the New York Times. His headline was Arab Revolution Knocking on Israel's Door. And the subhead for his article, The Israeli Response to Palestinian Protests, Killing 10 People in Lebanon, 8 in Syria, 2 in Gaza, and 1 in the West Bank, and injuring over 200. So immediately, if you were paying attention, you could see the difference between the heads and the subheads of these two articles describing the same events as they occurred last Sunday, Bloody Sunday. Of course, there was no uplifting U2 anthem to commemorate what occurred last Sunday, as there was where it concerned the troubles in Ireland. We'll be back in a minute.
God is on our side.
your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. We're talking about the next flashpoint, which is going to be the ongoing and forever Israeli-Palestinian conflict. New York Times cover story on Monday and photograph written by Ethan Bonner, and Asia Times, same event covered by Pepe Escobar, Arab Revolution Knocking on Israel's Door is the title in Asia Times. This is the way the Times starts out. New York Times. Israel's borders erupted in deadly clashes on Sunday as thousands of Palestinians marching from Syria, Lebanon, Gaza, and the West Bank confronted Israeli troops to mark the anniversary of Israel's creation. More than a dozen people were reported killed and scores injured. With an unprecedented wave of coordinated protests, the popular uprisings that have swept the region touched Israel directly for the first time. Like those other protests, plans for this one spread over social media, including Facebook. But there were also signs of official support in Lebanon and Syria, where analysts said leaders were using the Palestinian cause to deflect attention from internal problems. Okay, that's the New York Times. Ethan Bronner, Pepe Escobar in the Asia Times. Israel can always get away with killing Arabs wholesale because it fears no UN Security Council resolution. The U.S. always blocks them. Even if there were any, the U.S. administration of target executioner-in-chief Barack Obama would not, for instance, instruct U.S. Ambassador Susan Rice to abstain from a U.N. condemnation. That's the kind of abstention that could also help the UN, for instance, to force Israel into accepting a two-state solution with Palestine. Forget about the UN Security Council, so eager to send the NATO military on an attacking rampage on the side of a dodgy bunch of Libyan rebels, effectively taking sides on a civil war. Forget about the UN Security Council even considering dealing with Israel as it treats Iran, slapping it with economic sanctions until it starts complying with international law. So you can see already the compare and contrast between two descriptions of the violence that is building once again in the Middle East. Ethan Bronner at the New York Times. At the Lebanese border, Israeli troops shot at hundreds of Palestinians trying to force their way across. The Lebanese military said 10 protesters were killed and more than 100 were wounded. Israel said it was investigating the casualties. In the Golan Heights, about 100 Palestinians living in Syria breached a border fence and crowded into the village of Majdal Shams, waving Palestinian flags. Troops fired on the crowd, killing 4 people. In the West Bank, about 1,000 protesters carrying Palestinian flags and throwing stones and occasional firecrackers and gasoline bombs fought with Israeli riot troops near the military checkpoint between Ramallah and Israel. Scores were injured, local medical officials said. And in Gaza, where when marchers crossed a security zone near the border, Israeli troops fired into the crowd, wounding dozens. That's Ethan Bronner, New York Times. Pepe Escobar, Asia Times. Forget about the Obama administration supporting the UN Security Council into giving Palestine a formal seat as a nation state at the UN. Over 100 nations, including recently Brazil, Argentina, and Norway, already recognize the legitimacy of Palestine. If that would ever happen, the Palestinian nation could sue the hell out of Israel in international courts of law over the systematic theft of Palestinian territory. Would Nobel Peace Prize winner Obama lose anything with this move? No. The powerful Israel lobby in Washington, led by AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, is already campaigning against him in 2012. Anyway, Obama won't do it. And on top of that, he will address the upcoming AIPAC annual meeting in Washington. if there is a Washington consensus, it's complicity in the Israeli regime. Israel, Escobar goes on, pays for over 100 illegal settlements in the West Bank, plus over 100 others that are considered, quote, illegal outposts, end quote, even under Israeli law. The U.S. supports them all via a complex network of Jewish and ultra-right-wing Christian so-called charities, Visa, MasterCard, and PayPal, all enable donations funding illegal settlements. When you compare and contrast the reporting and the background of these two stories, you see a difference. Ethan Bronner, the New York Times, tries to maintain what the New York Times style book requires where it concerns reporting on this issue. Facts as filtered through public perception over the past half century, whereas Pepe Escobar, writing from a more emotional point of view, tries to show what has become a cliche, the plight of the Palestinian people. More in a minute.
Listening to Mike Malloy. Turn down your speakers. It'll be our secret.
25 before the hour. Continuing the comparison between the reporting of a new wave of violence building in the Middle East. Last Sunday was the 63rd anniversary of what the Israelis call their declaration of independence and the Palestinians call the Nakba, or catastrophe, that occurred in 1948 when hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were forced out of their homes through expulsion and flight. And the way it's being reported by these two publications, Ethan Bronner at the New York Times writes, every year in mid-May, many Palestinians observe what they call the Nakba, or catastrophe, the anniversary of Israel's declaration of independence in 1948, and the war in which hundreds of thousands of Palestinians lost their homes through expulsion and flight. But this was the first year that Palestinian refugees and their supporters in Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Egypt, inspired by the recent protests around the Arab world, tried to breach Israel's military border from all sides. Ali Baraka, a Hamas representative in Lebanon, said, quote, the Palestinians are not less rebellious than other Arab peoples, end quote. At the end of the day, as a tense calm returned to the country's borders, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the protests had been aimed at destroying Israel and not creating a Palestinian state alongside it. Netanyahu said, quote, the leaders of these violent demonstrations, their struggle is not over the 1967 borders, but over the very existence of Israel, which they describe as a catastrophe that must be resolved. It is important that we look with open eyes at the reality and be aware of whom we are dealing with and what we are dealing with, end quote. Pepe Escobar, writing in the Asia Times, says, and yet this regime, the Israelis, is in serious trouble. Prime Minister Benjamin Bibi Netanyahu, for all his bluster, is scared to death. He badly needs the secular Russians of Israel Beitenu, which is Israel Our Home party, and the fundamentalist ultra-Orthodox Jews of Shas to remain in power, Shas being another political party. Former Moldavian bouncer turned Egyptian Israeli foreign minister Avigdor Lieberman, the leader of Israel Beitenu, eats Bibi for breakfast and routinely humiliates him. And then Bibi regains his self-respect by humiliating President Obama. All one needs to know is that Lieberman, the Israeli Lieberman, is the top political dog in Israel. On top of it, Escobar continues, Hebrew University demographer Sergio Pergola recently told the Jerusalem Post that Jews are already under 50% of the population in Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza combined. In an enlightening comparison with ultra-repressive Bahrain, where a Sunni minority rules over a Shiite majority, a Jewish minority rules over 1.4 million third-class Palestinian citizens of Israel, 2.6 million occupied Palestinians in the West Bank, and 1.5 million under siege in that gulag known as Gaza. Even Human Rights Watch has been forced to recognize that, quote, Palestinians face systematic discrimination merely because of their race, ethnicity, and national origin, depriving them of electricity, water, schools, and access to roads, while nearby Jewish settlers enjoy all of these state-provided benefits. Ethan Bronner at the New York Times. Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, saluted the protesters in a televised speech, referring to the dead as martyrs. He said, quote, the blood of Nakba fatalities was not spilled in vain. They died for the Palestinian people's rights and freedom. End quote. And as Ethan Bronner points out, violence could return to define this conflict, relatively quiet for the past 2 years. He quotes a 16-year-old from Bethlehem who joined the protesters in Ramallah. This is war, said 16-year-old Amjad Abu Taha, a rock in one hand and a cigarette in the other. We are defending our country. Nearby, hundreds of Israeli troops roam the area using stun guns and tear gas. In Gaza, the Hamas police stopped buses carrying protesters near the main crossing into Israel, but dozens of demonstrators continued on foot, arriving at a point closer to the Israeli border than they had reached in years, and drawing Israeli fire. Pepe Escobar in the Asia Times. Surveying the tragic landscape, Palestinians came to the conclusion that there were only three possibilities on the table. The apartheid continues forever. In the unlikely possibility of a one-state solution, the apartheid would continue for a long time until a lot of Israelis, faced with a global boycott, would decide to emigrate or vote for citizenship for the Palestinians. Or third, Palestinians or Palestine could force its international recognition as an independent state. But finally getting their act together and trying to unite Fatah and Hamas, Palestinians came to grips with the fact that there can possibly be no meaningful negotiations with a weak, ultra-right-wing, fractured Israeli government, essentially controlled by a bunch of squatters, also known as settlers. Thus, the new Palestinian strategy, a relatively unified Palestine going all out for widespread recognition during the next UN General Assembly in September, recognition of a Palestine state based on the West Bank and Gaza under the 1967 borders. There's no question they will win the vote. Back to Ethan Bronner at the New York Times. Later, in a separate episode, an 18-year-old Gazan near another part of the border fence was shot and killed by Israeli troops when, the Israeli military says, he was trying to plant an explosive. The chief Israeli military spokesman, Brigadier General Yoav Mordechai, said on Israel radio that he saw Iran's fingerprints in the coordinated confrontations, although he offered no evidence. There are signs of grassroots support, for these protests. Palestinian activists have called on the internet for a mass uprising against Israel to have begun last Saturday. A Facebook page calling for a third Palestinian intifada, or uprising, had gathered more than 300 members before it was taken down after complaints that comments posted to it advocate violence. Pepe Escobar. The next step would have to be a UN Security Council resolution forcing Israel into serious negotiations. If the U.S. does not block it, if Tel Aviv still said no after such a resolution, soon the bulk of the world would start applying economic and diplomatic sanctions to Israel, similar to those applied to apartheid South Africa. So, the question the whole world is asking is inevitable. What's wrong with these people? He's referring, of course, to the Israelis. Escobar goes on, whenever they are in geopolitical trouble, Israeli elites cannot but react with the feeling of being victimized. Mubarak's case is exemplary, as he conveniently followed Washington's and Tel Aviv's orders and duly obeyed the Camp David Accords, repudiated by the overwhelming majority of Egyptians. Over the years, the Israeli attitude has engendered widespread paranoia, as in repeated attempts to unmask a possible internal fifth column in Israel. It was mixed with virtually total desensitization concerning the daily tragedy in Gaza, the stealing of West Bank land, and the arrogant swagger increasingly displayed by radical settlers, plus equating any criticism of the Israeli government was connected to advocating the, quote, destruction of Israel. Yet all this paled in comparison with the growing consensus among Israelis that it's all right to transfer, that's the code word for expel, Israeli Arab citizens to a possible future collection of Bantustans that the Palestinian people will never accept. What I'm trying to do here is show the comparison between the newspaper of record, the New York Times, reporting on the violence that began again last Sunday in the Middle East, and an interpretation of that violence as reported by Pepe Escobar in the Asia Times. We'll be right back.
Peace, salam, shalom. Peace, salam, shalom.
Compare and contrast. New York Times on Monday reporting on the Israeli troops opening fire as Palestinians tried to breach the borders of the State of Israel in protest to the establishment of the State of Israel 63 years ago. How it was reported by the New York Times, how it was reported by the Asia Times. New York Times written by Ethan Bronner, Asia Times written by Pepe Escobar. Back to New York Times. In Egypt, political organizers worked for weeks to rally Egyptians around the idea of a third intifada. Posters went up on Lebanese highways reading, "People want to return to Palestine." Israel declared its independence May 14, 1948. The day's troubles began this past Sunday when an Israeli Arab truck driver rammed his truck into cars, a bus, and pedestrians in Tel Aviv, killing one man and injuring more than a dozen in what the police described as a terrorist attack. Later, hundreds of Lebanese, joined by Palestinians from more than 9 refugee camps in Lebanon, headed toward Marun al-Ras, scene of some of the worst fighting in the 2006 war between Israel and Hezbollah. About 250 people were stopped in the northern Sinai, where they were demonstrating for Egypt to open the border with Gaza, expel the Israeli ambassador, and stop selling natural gas to Israel. Several thousand Egyptians protested in front of the Israeli embassy in Cairo, waving Palestinian flags, clapping and chanting, "Down with Israel." After midnight, some protesters tried to storm the embassy and were repelled by Egyptian army guards, witnesses reported. In Jordan, 800 Palestinians were bused to the border, but security officials and local residents prevented them from going further. Protesters in Lebanon said they received permission from the army to enter the border areas near Marun al-Ras, classified as a militarily sensitive region. Hezbollah was believed to have helped coordinate the march. New York Times. Pepe Escobar finishes up. As it stands, every additional house built in any West Bank settlement means only one thing: no. No to peace, no to negotiations, no to Palestinian rights. Israeli peace activist and author Uri Avnery defines this behavior as, quote, moral insanity, end quote. As usual, it gets worse. Israel never defined its borders. When it was created, Zionists dreamed of an Eretz Israel from the Nile to the Euphrates. As the Euphrates is not in the market anymore, why not settle for the whole former Palestine mandate? That's the meaning of the Bibi Netanyahu gambit, according to which Palestinians must recognize Israel as, quote, the Jewish state, end quote. The Obama administration has never complained. Were this recognition of a Jewish state ever to happen, 1.5 million Palestinians will be instantly denationalized and set to be expelled en masse to the Palestinian Bantustan, configured as the solution to the so-called demographic problem, as Zionists see it, a problem created by the fact that the Palestinians simply exist. So, in the Israeli narrative, the Israel Defense Forces could have pulverized Gaza to dust, but it didn't, because it respects human life, thus destroying, quote, only, end quote, 15% of Gaza's buildings and killing, quote, only 300 of its children in late 2008, early 2009 could be sold and accepted by Israelis as a humanitarian act. As for East Jerusalem, it should be purified. None of this, of course, ever arouses the ire of the UN Security Council. Purified, meaning the expulsion of Palestinians. The world knows, Escobar writes, that Israel has gotten away with killing and torturing tens of thousands of Palestinians over the past 63 years because of the unconditional support of Washington. Perhaps the next UN General Assembly in September will be a game changer. A new, really representative, really sovereign Egyptian government will definitely be a game changer because, to Tel Aviv's horror, it will be the absolute opposite of Mubarak. Yet, what is already certain is that as long as the apartheid enshrined at the very core of Israel is not questioned by Israelis themselves, there is no evidence that the, quote, moral insanity of the, quote, pathological state is abating. So there you have it. Let the Malloy, you're a Jew-hater email begin. I certainly expect it. This is a topic that most people stay away from. You just don't talk about this issue on American radio. You don't dare, or television. You don't dare! Oh, my God. But it was very interesting to me, anyway, to read the two accounts of the same event. Ethan Bronner at the New York Times, who I believe writes in a very journalistic style. He's a very fair writer, no problem with that. Pepe Escobar, who is not writing as a journalist, but is writing more as someone who is interpreting, which, of course, journalism tells you you're not to do, interpreting the events there. But the difference in the flavor of the two articles, the difference in the focus of the two articles is what struck me. The disaster that occurred to the Palestinian people, I don't care how anyone spins it, Arab or Jew, liberal or conservative, doesn't make any difference to me. The disaster, it's the only word for it, that the Palestinian people experienced in the lead-up to the establishment of the State of Israel is well documented. You cannot deny history. You can attempt to rewrite it, but you can't deny it. So the situation in that bloody, sad, horrific part of the world continues. And like I said at the beginning of sharing with these two articles with you, in my opinion, a third intifada is about to erupt, and the blood will begin to flow once again in that sad part of the world. I'll see you tomorrow. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.